Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Negotiations over raising the federal debt ceiling appear to have broken down. Republicans and Democrats can't agree on a compromise that will allow the country to continue paying its bills. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner warned yesterday that time is running out and markets are getting nervous.
We're running out of runway. We're almost at the edge. I never thought they would take it this close to the edge and let politics get in the way of demonstrating that we'll pay our bills on time.
But Republican Senator John Kyle of Arizona on Fox News Sunday continued to insist that Congress will meet its bottom line commitment to avoid default.
We will pass an extension of the debt ceiling, and the only question is for how long.
This hour, On Point, the debt ceiling debate goes down to the wire. You can join the conversation. Are we headed for a financial calamity? What shape will the final compromise take, and will we have one at all? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now are two lawmakers at the center of this battle. Congressman Chris Van Hollen is the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee. He joins me from Kensington, Maryland. Congressman Van Hollen, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, John.
And also joining me from Washington, Republican Congressman Tom Cole. He is also on the House Budget Committee, serves on the Appropriations Committee as well. Congressman Cole, welcome to the show.
John, great to be with you.
Now, Tom Cole, let me start with you. I know both you and Chris Van Hollen to be two of the saner members of Congress, but to many Americans listening to this program and watching this debate around the country, they think what's happening in Washington is insane. What's happening right now, and how's this going to be resolved?
Well, I think that clearly we're in a major policy dispute, and we have an opportunity and a challenge. The opportunity is to begin seriously to deal with what we all know is a structural debt problem. And frankly, I'm pleased that we have made the progress we have. There's no way a debt ceiling is going to be raised without significant spending cuts over the long term. That's something, by the way, that's never happened before, to my knowledge. Certainly hasn't happened in my time in Congress. So it's a major achievement. The real question now is, what's the shape of the deal going to be, and why are we taking so long to put it together? You know, and in that regard, I think, frankly, in my view, the president's not been helpful. I think he changed the nature of the deal. I think they were closer last week than one might believe, but I think the president's insistence, after Speaker Boehner thought he had a deal on revenue, of upping the ante, so to speak, was not helpful. And I think now, even when there is a possibility of a two-step process that would work, that is some cuts now, an extension, and then a few months to work on a longer-term deal that both sides could agree on, I think the president is probably undercutting that as well. I think Senator Reid might have been willing to agree to that, but I think the White House feels like it needs to be, number one, in the middle of anything, whether it's helpful or not that they're there. And number two, I think the president clearly wants to put any discussions on deficit reduction past the election. He would argue for market certainty, I think for political advantage. This is not a debate that he particularly wants to have. And frankly, it's a debate that we need to have and are going to have over the next decade.
So, Chris Van Hollen, Tom Cole says it's President Obama's fault because he's worried about reelection and angering his own base. What do you say?
Well, what's never happened before, John, is the United States has never intentionally defaulted on its debt. We've never said that we refuse to pay our bills, and there's a good reason for that, because the consequences for the economy would be catastrophic. It would mean the United States became a deadbeat nation when it comes to paying our bills, and interest rates would be jacked up, and you'd see terrible consequences throughout the economy. So taking this debate to the very brink, as our Republican colleagues have had, and arguing that if they don't get things 100% their way, they'll take us over the cliff, has been a very reckless approach.
But Tom Cole just said that President Obama reneged on a deal with Republicans.
That is just not the case. I mean, this is the Republican spin. The reality is the president put on the table a very balanced approach, $3 in spending cuts to $1 in revenue, modeled after the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission. And the reality is that Republicans refuse to allow for a mechanism that would guarantee at the end of the day they made good on the revenue component, that we were able to close these tax loopholes and generate income for deficit reduction. From the beginning, we've had a problem. As Tom knows, they've got a lot of very right-wing Tea Party folks in their caucus who just absolutely refuse to compromise, even when necessary for the good of the country. We've got to resolve this. I mean, Tom's right. And we also have to have a plan to get the deficit down. But we shouldn't be doing this month to month. I mean, you know, what the Republicans are proposing now is, hey, let's just kick the can down to December and face the same situation once again. This is a self-inflicted wound. We shouldn't be doing that to the United States of America. We're beginning to look like a third world country the way we're operating here.
Let me ask you this, though. Why? I remember earlier in the spring, the president himself and members of his administration said what you don't want to have, because it would be destabilizing to the markets, is a countdown clock on raising the debt limit. Too dangerous. Why have we not seen more of an adverse reaction from markets so far? They seem oddly sanguine that this is going to get worked out in the end.
Well, of course, John, we have not passed the critical hour. I mean, we've not passed the August 2nd date. We've not gotten to the point where the cash coming in is not sufficient to pay for our bills. And so we haven't gotten to the point where the United States has stopped making good on its full faith and credit. I'm quite confident, and this is backed up by, you know, independent rating agencies, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, that you get to that point, you are going to see bad consequences in the economy, and that will hurt every American family.
Tom Cole, let me ask you this about the short-term versus long-term deal. Your side has said, the speaker yesterday on a Sunday talk show, that the president's playing politics. He's worried about his reelection. That's why he wants to wipe it off the table. What about the politics on your side? All of your members are up for reelection next year. Why do they want to vote again on a debt ceiling? And is it because they want to keep casting no votes because they think it'll help their election?
No, I actually think they don't want to keep voting on it. That's actually the sentiment. But frankly, the president has sort of dawdled on this whole process. You mentioned the Simpson-Bowles Commission earlier, or Chris did. You know, that was a presidentially appointed commission. He's never embraced that commission. He submitted, came to State of the Union address, didn't talk about debt until like halfway through his speech.
But your caucus is now attacking the president for one of the core elements of Simpson-Bowles, which was revenue.
Well,
why wouldn't they have done the same thing in December?
My caucus is actually the only one that's voted to raise the debt ceiling so far. We actually have a plan on the table. The Senate didn't even give us the courtesy of picking it up and debating it. They simply tabled it. You know, I think we have a lot of Republicans that have already demonstrated they will vote to raise the debt ceiling, but they want serious deficit reduction. The president, by the way, you know, took the tax issue off the table in December. He cut a deal in December to let's deal with the Bush tax cuts 2 years from now. Now we're 6 months into a two-year deal, and he's trying to change the terms again. I think the president has been the one who's been lackadaisical and inconsistent. I agree, by the way, with what Chris says. I think this is a very serious point. I think we need to find a solution. I think Speaker Boehner has been trying for both a big deal. Now he thinks, well, that's not achievable. Let's buy some time and continue working together congressionally, see if we can solve this thing. But, you know, if we could find something between now and August the 2nd that would be a larger deal, I think, you know, I think the Speaker would be able to deliver most of the Republican coffers for that, as he did, by the way, on cut, cap, and balance.
Let me ask you a purely political question. Both of you have worked at high levels in the campaign committees of your party. You used to head the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee and the Republican National Committee. Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, said the other day that the Senate Republican leader said that we ought to give President Obama the authority to raise the debt limit. And the reason is, if we drive this car into the ditch on the debt limit, Republicans will be co-owners of the bad economy, and that's a bad position going into the election. Why has that argument not cut more ice with Republican members in the House?
I think largely because it is a purely political argument. And I agree with the politics of Senator McConnell's statement. I have real problems, and I think most of my colleagues do, regardless of where they are in the ideological spectrum, with that kind of process. Congress simply turning over debt-raising authority to the president without any specification of what cuts are going to occur, I think is just unacceptable. That might get a majority of Democratic votes, but it'll never get a majority of Republicans.
Do your members really not care what happens to them in the election next year?
No, I think they do care very much, but I think they also came here to try and get some things done. They're moving in that direction. We are reducing spending dramatically. This is another opportunity to do it. But they're not going to go home and say, gee, I turned over the entire debt situation to the president to sort of do what he wanted to. I think that's not only a politically loser, I think that's constitutionally very suspect, and that's an abdication of our authority.
Chris Van Hollen, help me game out the final week here. Everybody's talked about how there's limited time procedurally to get something moving, and yet you have two separate vehicles, one in the House, one in the Senate, being developed. You also hear that there remains goodwill between John Boehner, Harry Reid in the Senate, even with President Obama, that they all want to get a solution. I know it's hard to get people to follow their leaders, but tell me how this is going to get resolved. Is somebody going to blink, or are they going to be able to fudge the differences?
Well, as Tom indicated, at the leadership level, both in the White House and in Congress, both parties, I think there's a desire to get it done. I think it's been made much more difficult by the Tea Party group in the House because they have dug their feet in on a lot of compromise proposals. Now, the big issue now is the length of time by which we're going to extend the debt ceiling. The president's absolutely right that we shouldn't put our country voluntarily in exactly the situation predicament we're in today, this coming December, January, when we have it within our power to extend the debt ceiling through January of 2013. And just to remind everybody, these are for bills that have already accumulated. I mean, these are actions that the United States has already signed up.
Chris Van Hollen and Tom Cole, I know you guys have got to get to work. We're running out of time. We're talking about the debt ceiling crisis and how we move forward. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the debt ceiling crisis in Washington. Joining me now is Dan Mitchell. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, where he specializes in tax policy. Dan Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm great. And also joining us is Neera Tanden. She's the chief operating officer at the Center for American Progress, former director of domestic policy for the Obama-Biden presidential campaign. Neera Tanden, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dan Mitchell, let me start with you. How concerned are you about the economic and financial market consequences of Congress failing to agree to raise the debt limit?
If you're asking me about 6 months to forever, I'm not concerned at all. I do think there's some risk of a short-term hiccup in the markets because Geithner especially, but also Bernanke, are trying to rattle financial markets for political gain, which I think is just downright reprehensible on their part. But we all know that the Treasury
Department... Why does Bernanke care about political gain?
Because he's basically been an ally of the Obama administration on everything from the stimulus to government-run health care to you name it. But the key thing is that we're going to collect about 10 times as much revenue as we need to pay interest payments. So there is zero danger of any actual default unless Geithner actually wants to default, which I hope that his political machinations don't extend that far.
But don't we have a few seniors out there who want their Social Security checks chewed?
Oh, that's a completely different issue. Would there be significant disruptions because the federal government has said it's going to spend $3.7 trillion and it's only going to collect $2.3 trillion? Yes, there would be significant disruption, which is why sooner or later we will increase the debt limit. But there is zero chance of default. Every single reporter and every single network and every single program is so flat out wrong that I sometimes think I'm in a parallel universe where nobody does their homework.
Well, let's not call it default. Let's call it tremendous disruption involving Social Security, Medicare, the military services, veterans benefits, all that sort of thing. Isn't all of that a bad enough set of consequences to require raising the debt limit not just sooner but right now?
It's certainly something that would be very politically disruptive and certainly could have a negative effect on terms of the cash flow of vendors and benefit recipients of different government programs. But remember, this whole issue is about will there be economic and financial calamity because of default? And the answer is no. That's never been the issue, except to the extent that the administration is trying to make it an issue to scare Republicans into folding their tent.
Neera Tanden, I know the media almost never actually hypes a story, but are we hyping this one?
I think it's very important that these last series of points that Dan made, because I think what the argument he's making is essentially that in order to pay creditors, and I believe we cannot default and we should not default. And I mourn the political situation we're in right now, that that's even a question to anyone. But I also think that it is a conservative view that it's important to pay bankers and financial creditors and to ignore the liabilities and the necessary payments to the American people. And that is a conservative philosophy that Dan embraces. And I think that's, you know, many Americans would also like Social Security, Medicare payments, payments to our soldiers to be a top priority for political leaders. And the fact that those are jeopardized as well is a calamity. And I would say, like, you know, it's not, you know, Democrats who are continually calling. I mean, they're members of Wall Street of both political persuasions who are urging action. The Chamber of Commerce is not a liberal lapdog. It is urging action to resolve this issue. And I think that it is a statement of how politically out of the mainstream we are that people would like to not pay seniors in order to avoid a default.
Neera, let me ask you about one point that piqued my interest that Dan made in the beginning, and that was the idea that Ben Bernanke is hyping this crisis because he is in bed with all your friends at the White House on health care and economic policy and that sort of thing. What do you think of that argument?
I think that this is a lens in which politics dominates everything and ideology dominates everything. The idea that Ben Bernanke is some kind of liberal mouthpiece, and that his series of policies on monetary policy, et cetera, are things that liberals are pushing for. He's a moderate centrist, economic, pragmatic person who would like to avoid putting massive weights on our economy as we're trying to move towards economic growth. And he identifies this situation as one of them. And I would trust his views and those views over those who tell us not to worry.
Dan, just real quickly on Neera's point, isn't in fact he a moderate centrist Republican since he was appointed by President George W. Bush?
George W. Bush had one of the most big government administrations in the last 60 years. He was far worse than Bill Clinton. Matter of fact, I would gladly take Bill Clinton back today over what we had under the 8 years of Bush. And Obama's basically picked up the baton from Bush and raced in the same direction. Look, here's the reality. We know that we don't have to default. Now, maybe Neera's right and we should pay Social Security checks and default instead, but you know, let's set that aside. Bernanke is not an idiot. He knows that there's no reason why we have to default, and yet he's out there rattling financial markets. He's obviously tight with Geithner on all this stuff. He's been supporting the Obama administration from day one on their main initiatives, and he was reappointed by Obama. That doesn't make him a bad person. It just means that he's not someone that believes in limited government and individual freedom.
All right. Well, since Dan has now put Obama together with Bush as part of the same continuum, I think that's a good note to go to the callers, probably something to annoy everybody. We've got Chuck calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Chuck, what's your question?
Hi, John. I just wonder, someone mentioned earlier that they were feeling like they were in a parallel universe. I feel like I am sometimes when I'm listening to both sides, especially, I think, most poignantly, members of the Tea Party discussion, whenever what's blatantly absent is any lawmaker saying, including in our package of cuts, is a little break to the whole system by reducing our salaries and benefits by a slight amount in keeping with the rest of America who's had to tighten their belts. It seems like we're living in a pseudo-aristocracy, and I can't imagine that any lawmaker would really have any incentives to go further as long as they're sure that they will still get their paycheck no matter what.
Well, let's hear Dan Mitchell. Why not a slight reduction or a big reduction in those six-figure salaries?
I'd be all in favor of that, and not just for the politicians who, of course, get very, very generous salaries, probably, I don't know, four or five, six times the average American. The greater problem where the dollars really add up is you have the federal bureaucracy where average total compensation is twice as high as average compensation of people in the productive sector of the economy. So you have the people out there pulling the wagon who are earning only half as much as the people who are riding in the wagon. We have sort of this gilded elite of bureaucrats in Washington, and the politicians, of course, are the head of the snake, and they're just living fat and happy, the life of Riley, and the poor taxpayers out there are the ones suffering from stagnant wages because the mistakes of the political class in Washington have given us a stagnant economy. I think that, yes, they should take a pay cut.
Neera, as a member of the gilded, snaky elite, do you like the idea of pay cuts for members of Congress, or would that just ensure that we have more lame brains on Capitol Hill?
Look, if Republicans want to put forward proposals to us, you know, dramatically cut back on, you know, child care and food payments for mothers with infants, you know, I think it's important for them to also take a concomitant cut in their own pay. I think that would be actually a good idea because it shows that they would not like to just shift the suffering onto the people who cannot afford it. I would say, though, that I think we tend to look at government payments in terms of subsidies, and we forget, you know, subsidies to individuals. And my friends on the right often forget that we make a lot of payments to people in the forms of basically direct tax cuts. It's essentially a subsidy. It's a way we, in essence, provide incentives through the tax code for particular behaviors.
The president called it tax spending recently.
Right. And, you know, I think the challenge of that is that we should, for those who are livid at government expenditures and bureaucracies around government expenditures that are direct subsidies, they should be as livid about these expenditures that are essentially payments to corporations and companies that are essentially looking at Washington to provide them just essentially money. And I would argue that that funding is something we can afford to do without much more easily than direct cuts to Medicare and Social Security.
All right, let's go to a caller from the state of Minnesota, which has had its own budget and financial problems recently. We've got Jeff on the line from Wilmar. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. I would just make two comments. The Democrats have refused to have a written budget for over 2 years when they were in control of the House and the Senate. They did not give us a balance of a budget. They haven't. Now they've lost the House, and now they can't do it because we got the House with the Republicans. The Democrats are irresponsible in a couple cases with that situation. And also, cut, cap, and balance was passed. The senators, I believe it was five of them from the Democrats, have said no. And then John Boehner's thing of $800 billion, his deal with the president said no. This is the Democrats' fault. Because it goes back to that they could not pass a budget over 2 years ago. And so I'm getting sick and tired. I think the American people are sick and tired of the president getting up there and telling us what he thinks. Okay, we don't care what he thinks.
Neera Tanden, you're one of the big Democratic brains in town. You plead guilty to that?
Absolutely not. I would say that let's actually look at what caused this deficit and debt. Right now, if you look over the next decade, tax cuts and wars account for nearly half of the public debt. Let's remind ourselves that one of the biggest drivers of this debt is a bunch of policies that were passed in the Bush administration. And I applaud Dan because he recognizes the Bush administration were large government spenders. A large number of the Republicans who are sitting here fussing now didn't mind paying for having tax cuts passed that they didn't pay for. Didn't mind. In fact, supported a prescription drug bill that wasn't paid for. Democrats, in all of the proposals we put forward, pay for them. During the 8 years of the Bush administration, a series of large-scale public spending was never paid for. It was never offset by other spending reductions or tax increases.
But now they've passed cut, cap, and balance. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think the challenge of cut, cap, and balance is that essentially would, you know, basically create economic ruin for the country. It would hamstring the country so much that we would have massive cuts to Social Security, massive cuts to Medicare. I think, you know, many on the right, and Dan is more ideologically pure than many others, probably want that kind of dramatic cuts. But I think the American people have stated that, you know, their priorities. And poll after poll, they want a balanced approach to this. They reject the ideas of cut, cap, and balance. I'm fascinated by the fact that Republicans embrace it so much when it's so it's rejected by many Republicans in poll after poll. So I think, you know, if we were living in a representative democracy, people would like a shared approach. What's challenging about the system we have right now is Republicans refuse to do essentially what the American people want, which is to have everyone be part of the solution. Middle-class Americans did not create this deficit and debt. It was a series of policies that require everyone to be involved, and we're looking at a series of policies in cut, cap, and balance where the entire burden of the debt reduction package is on middle class and lower class, lower income Americans.
Let's talk about real Americans and what we can do in this debate about jobs. We've got Sam on the line from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. A great program. This whole conversation is breathtaking in its, stupidity and forgetfulness. I mean, one day no one's talking about a deficit problem. The next day, everyone's talking about a deficit problem. Shame on both the Democrats and Republicans for making up this issue and creating it as a distraction from the real economy. And I think both parties are as guilty. You know, they both have a hand in it. I mean, it's true that a lot of the deficit problem is because of policies of the Bush administration, the wars, the huge tax cuts. Democrats have an equal hand in that. It was under Clinton that all the problems with banking deregulation really came to a head. Robert Rubin can take credit for that. And I guess he won a Nobel Peace Prize, didn't he? The Nobel Peace Prize winning president commits 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan that no one's in favor of that I know. And I think the real issue is the economy, the real economy, and why we're in such a mess and what we can do about it.
Let's talk to our guests on that. Dan Mitchell, what about it? Are we forgetting the real economy in all this discussion about numbers?
Well, unfortunately, sometimes I think we are. And actually, I want to embrace something that Neera said. Yes, I do want to do something like cut, cap, and balance. I do want to do something like the Ryan Plan, because basically what you have under the proposals, like the Ryan Plan, is a proposal to have government spending grow about 2.5 to 3% a year. Well, that's exactly what it was growing during the Bill Clinton years, when we went from a big deficit to a big surplus and our economy grew. The key to economic growth is allowing resources to be deployed by the productive sector of the economy. We don't want capital and labor being misallocated by a bunch of politicians and bureaucrats in Washington. That's the French model. That hasn't worked. We're going to become like Greece, like Portugal, like the other European welfare states if we let government get bigger and bigger. So by all means, I want to go back to the Bill Clinton level of fiscal responsibility that we see in cut, cap, and balance. That's a plan to slow down government spending so it only grows a little bit faster than inflation.
Well, wasn't the Bill Clinton level of financial responsibility 39.6 tax rates?
Hey,
I have
a trade for Neera. If she's willing to go back to federal government spending at 18.2% of GDP, which is where it was when Bill Clinton left office, I'd be willing to go back to a 39.6% tax rate. That would be a huge win for economic freedom in America.
But, Dan, let me ask you one more thing about Neera's point on cut, cap, and balance. Don't we know from the little reaction, the Republican defeat in the special election earlier this year after the Ryan budget, that cuts on the scale that are contemplated by cut, cap, and balance simply cannot be sustained politically at the ballot box?
There are no cuts in cut, cap, and balance other than rhetorical cuts. Government would grow every single year under these Republican budget plans. It's only using dishonest Washington budget math where if you increase spending at, say, 6% instead of 8%, you call that a budget cut. I don't believe in dishonesty.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the debt crisis and the politics of the solution. We're talking this hour with Neera Tanden. She's Chief Operating Officer at the Center for American Progress and a former Director of Domestic Policy for the Obama-Biden presidential campaign. And also Dan Mitchell, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, where he specializes in tax policy. And joining us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, welcome.
Hi, John.
Nancy, I want to play for you a clip yesterday from White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley on NBC's Meet the Press, when he insisted that if the president is sent a short-term debt ceiling increase, he'll veto it.
Senator McConnell, Speaker Boehner, Senator Reid, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi have all said the debt ceiling will be extended. But it must be extended in a way that gives certainty to the economy through 13 and not some short-term gimmick where we're right back in this fix in 6 or 8 months.
Nancy, do Republican leaders in Congress think the president is bluffing with that veto threat, or do they take it seriously?
I think that they think that he's bluffing, and that if they can somehow ram through Republican legislation through the House first and then through the Senate that does include this two-step process, they essentially want to dare the president to veto it and set him up for a situation where he has to decide, do I put this country into default because I'm unwilling to accept the Republican plan or not?
Well, and aren't Senate leaders trying to beat John Boehner to that spot by moving a plan separately that would not be short term, that would go through 2012? And somebody at the end, as these two cars head down the same path right at one another, somebody's got to blink.
Exactly. I mean, what you've got right now is a setup for this week where you're going to have dueling legislation, Harry Reid's legislation in the Senate and Speaker Boehner's legislation in the House, essentially duking it out. And that's why you heard Speaker Boehner in that conference call that he held with House Republicans on Sunday telling them, look, some of you are going to need to compromise. And what that was code for was, hey, all of you who have said that you're not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling under any circumstances, I need you to get on my side with this legislation, because if he doesn't have them on his side, he cannot pass his plan through the House and send it over to the Senate.
Well, I agree with you. I thought that language was very significant. You know, some people interpreted the text of that call as a defiant stand. But what I heard was he said, we passed cut, gap, and balance. We did our job, past tense. Now we've got to find something that can pass both houses. It looks like he's conditioning his members to accept, perhaps, if they decide the president is serious about long-term, to somehow accept a two-stage process that doesn't require another vote on the debt ceiling. Do you think that John Boehner, and what's the evidence that we've seen, that he can lead members to a conclusion like that?
Well, I think what he wants right now is just for them to vote for his two-step process, because he knows that if they do, then he's got the edge in this war of legislation. And that's because over in the Senate, where Leader Reid would need 60 votes to get his legislation passed through that body, he doesn't have the votes if no Republicans come on board. So if Republicans can pass their plan single-handedly in the House and Reid can't get his bill out of the Senate, then Boehner's got the upper hand.
Well, Neera, is that in fact the situation, that you have leaders, Republican leader in the House, Democratic leader in the Senate, racing to the same spot? But because of the rules of the House and the ability to pass with majority vote, he's got the advantage in getting there first.
Well, absolutely. The House always has the ability to move everything much faster just because of the nature of its rules. But I would say one additional point is, I mean, if people actually held to their views, you have a number of Republicans who signed off on the Gang of Six proposal. And if you signed off on the Gang of Six proposal, what Harry Reid and what's been discussed in the last 24 hours has put forward, it's to the right of the Gang of Six proposal in that it has no revenue. It's not as large a number, but it has no revenue. So if Senate Republicans were ideologically consistent at all, there'd be no reason that they would oppose the $2.9 trillion. They would have 60 votes in the Senate, assuming he could put together every Democrat, which would be hard to do, but assuming he could do that. The question is, will Senate Republicans act politically to put aside their views, their preferences, and I would argue the good of the country in order to ensure that Speaker Boehner has the strongest hand to get what he wants out of threatening, severe economic consequences from a default or whatever Dan would call it.
Dan, let me ask you about the role of a couple of senators in particular. We saw Mitch McConnell a couple of weeks ago say, give the president the authority himself to raise the debt ceiling, because if we don't, and there's a calamity, Republicans are co-owners of the bad economy. You subsequently had 20 Republican senators embrace the Gang of Six, including a member of the Republican leadership, Lamar Alexander. What does that tell you about where Republican votes and where their sentiments are on the Hill right now?
The Senate is a much more of a mixed bag for the GOP than the House. The House, you have everything from leadership, the Tea Party guys who came to town anxious to make a lot of changes. The Senate has, you know, what are called the old bulls, the old guard, you know, the moderates. They're all over the place. McConnell, his proposal, I think, is tactically clever, but it's sort of premised on the idea that we can't win this. The president has the bully pulpit, so therefore let's give him a way of raising the debt limit without us having our fingerprints on it, with us being the other Republican members. That may be smart politics, but it is throwing in the towel and letting America go 2 years farther down the path to becoming another Greece. The Gang of Six is a much more interesting animal, because it's anti-Obama in the sense that there's no class warfare tax increases. As a matter of fact, they actually propose to lower the top tax rates. Of course, they would have a net tax revenue increase, but lower tax rates, very much like the 1986 thing. And so, yeah, there are a lot of Republicans who, because that has parts of the 86 Tax Reform Act, plus at least some reforms on the spending side, a lot of the especially moderate Republicans are willing to go with that, because unlike Obama, the Senate Democrats who are part of that are willing to meet them at least part of the way.
All right, we're talking about Mitch McConnell. Let's go to Mitch McConnell's home state. We've got George on the line from Bowling Green, Kentucky. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the moment. It's been an interesting day. I have three questions, and I'll leave you guys to struggle with the answers. First of all, why don't we just create a common sense party and send them both out to pasture? Secondly, how can anybody in his right mind sign a no revenue increase pledge in any part of the world we know? And thirdly, how on earth can you possibly commit to a balanced budget when you are the lender of last resort?
All right, let me start with Nancy on the first of George's questions about the common sense political party. We have had, Nancy, some movements to have no labels parties and some sort of a centrist element spring up. They haven't seemed to go anywhere lately. What are the prospects for that?
Right. And if you look at the polls, you would think that movements like that would have a great shot, because you have more and more people identifying themselves as independents. But I think what you've seen in the last few elections is people so frustrated by both parties that instead of electing people who are in the middle, they, you know, they sort of have this throw the bums out mentality, and, you know, you sort of swing wildly from one party to the next in every election. I think going back to Dan's point about the Gang of Six and how it's been embraced by Senate Republicans, but not so much by House Republicans, I think that that's a sign that moderate Republicans in the Senate seem to be more comfortable asserting themselves than moderate House Republicans. They do exist. But they know that it's not politically wise right now to be for something that's in the middle. I've spoken to House Republicans privately who have said throughout this debate, you know, I actually wouldn't mind some increases in tax revenue, especially if it was balanced out by such large spending cuts. That's a compromise that I could live with.
Do they cover their mouths when they say that to you?
They're not comfortable saying that publicly.
Do they cover their mouths when they say that to you?
They do. I mean, that's something that they're not at all comfortable saying publicly, because they know that that the Tea Party has a lot of the mojo in their party right now, and that's certainly the wing that Speaker Boehner seems to be catering to at the moment.
Dan, let me ask you and then have Neera respond to one of the policy questions that George raised, which was, if you have a balanced budget amendment, don't you bind yourself on economic policy for times in which you might need to run a deficit? Dan?
Well, your question is sort of accepts the premise that you want Keynesian fine-tuning so-called stimulus ability. I've never been a big fan of a balanced budget amendment, in large part because I think anything that might ever have a prayer of passing would be so watered down it would be basically no different than just keeping the status quo. But the fundamental debate, and I think Neera will agree with me on this, is both parties pretend to care about deficits, but it's really a debate about the size of government. Republicans mostly say they're against tax increases because they view that as a way of at least somehow restraining government spending, because at least in theory, up until the last couple of years, you couldn't borrow too much money. And Democrats want higher taxes, but they don't want to really advertise that. So mostly they try to get Republicans to agree to the tax increase deals so they can have bigger spending and more government. But that's what the debate is about. Neera wants more government. I want less government. Republicans and Democrats don't really want to have that honest argument that Neera and I will have. So they both use code words and try to use the deficit as a weapon against each other.
Neera, are you worried that a balanced budget amendment would be a straitjacket for economic policy?
I worry about that, and I think that is a significant concern. And I would argue that if you look at austerity policies that are taking place in other countries, for example, in Britain, we are seeing a massive, we're seeing real economic dislocation and greater economic slowdown because of their austerity policies. And some argue, including President Clinton, that there's a real chance that they'll lower their they'll get much less revenue from what they're doing, and so all of their policies will actually have a spiraling effect downwards on their economy. I would say one thing about what Dan said about sort of an honest debate about these issues, and I think I agree that there's, he is willing to have an honest debate about the size of government, and I believe I'm willing to have that debate. But I would say the issue with
the
Republican Party.
So you two are the last two honest people in Washington?
No, there are definitely others. But I'd say for political leaders, I mean, the challenge about what we're really talking about now is a size of government, but what the government also does. And what's challenging about this debate about revenues is that, Democrats are willing to look at essentially government expenditures through another name. And what's challenging about this debate is that Republicans are willing to look at some spending, we would argue spending for middle-class Americans or entitlements and direct spending, but have used this cloud of no revenue and saying no tax increases, et cetera, to make us unable to even look at tax expenditures and spending that basically goes directly to corporations and higher and wealthy folks in many different ways. And so I think it's hard to say people are really looking at deficit and debt when they're saying we're going to take this part of the budget off the table that helps companies and corporations. But we really want a plan here that only looks at spending that helps middle-class American or lower-income Americans. And I think that's a challenge with a BBA that doesn't allow you to look at revenue and just cuts that off completely, a balanced budget amendment. And that's a challenge in this entire debate when because of pledges, and this gets to another question, because pledges people have made in their primaries to advance in a primary or in a general election, they are unwilling to look at essentially deductions, direct corporate subsidies, other things that are obviously just a spending in another name.
All right. I want to go to Brattleboro, Vermont. We've got Jerry on the line with what I think is a very bottom line oriented question. Jerry, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, John. Yes. I think this, as the 70-year-old, I think it's ridiculous that we have both parties doing this. They should be put on permanent recess and they should be issued their pink slips ASAP. And I'm hauling both parties because I think they're both spendthrifts. And I'm just calling for all the people that have money to take it out of their bank, and let's do something that's very important, is call their bluff and pull our money out and see where this goes. Because if Social Security fails and Medicare, which we have paid for, is no longer solvent, then the power is in the people. And since the parties are failing, we need to do something. Thank you.
Nancy, let me put that one to you and get your sense as you talk to members of Congress. Set the numbers aside, set the ideology aside. To what degree are those members of Congress thinking about 70-year-old callers like that when they make decisions on the debt limit, and how scared are they about an adverse reaction if they don't get it done?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was all this concern over the weekend that perhaps the breakdown in the talks between Speaker Boehner and the president might set off the Asian markets when they opened on Sunday night, and that there might be hell to pay, that essentially the Asian investors would end up losing patience with us and just fear that no deal was going to get done. And there were some people that were kind of rooting for that because they thought, well, that would be terrible, but at least it would sort of concentrate the minds of leaders on Capitol Hill, and it would force everyone off of their rigid positions. And finally, and maybe if things were so bad in the Asian markets, maybe they would even work through the night and realize that they needed to do something to reassure people before the U.S. markets opened
kind
in the morning.
Kind of like what happened when the first TARP vote went down and the market
exactly.
plunged 700 points.
But then, you know, wouldn't you know it, there was some reaction, but it was pretty mild, not enough to keep anyone awake at night. And so what you see this morning is people more dug in than ever. I mean, normally, and what makes this situation so unusual here on Capitol Hill is, you know, everybody stakes out their ground. But when you get close to the deadline, you've got to make a deal. Here, the closer we get to the deadline, the more people are digging in. Even today, we're hearing these statements, you know, we will not accept anything. We're going to, you know, we're not going to come off of our negotiating positions, which makes it really difficult to see. You know, everybody says there will be no default. Everyone says there will be a deal at the end of the day, but the outlines of that deal are becoming less and less clear.
But Nancy, how confident are you that what we think we see, that is them getting more dug in, is really what we're seeing as opposed to the darkness before the dawn of a deal?
You know, I think that there's not a lot of hope right now for bipartisanship. Everyone has been pretty clear that that sort of broke down over the weekend. I think everyone's now going to have to try this two-stage approach with Republicans introducing their plan and the other side introducing theirs, and then let the chips fall where they may. And
well,
it may be that we need the U.S. markets to respond before they really get together.
The chips are about to start falling. Nancy Cordes of CBS, Dan Mitchell of Cato, Neera Tanden of the Center for American Progress, thanks so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and On Point Radio on Facebook. I'm John Harwood for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.